Podcasting from the Garden State, welcome to another edition of the New Jersey Legal Update, presented by Stark & Stark, a 100-attorney law firm with offices in Princeton, Cherry Hill, Philadelphia, and New York. The New Jersey Legal Update is a weekly podcast providing the latest information on legal developments impacting those living or doing business in New Jersey.
Hi, this is John McDonald. I'm here with Adam Siegelheim. We're both members of the Franchise Practices Group at Stark & Stark, and we're here to talk about some recent case law development. It's much more interesting than that just sounded, so we'll try to give you our thoughts on some new cases and what franchisees and franchisors can gain from these. Adam, I don't know if you want to talk first. I'm going to be talking about something near and dear to my heart, which is some Krispy Kreme donut cases, but Adam, you're going to be talking about what?
I'm going to be talking about when in New Jersey, if you want to go to arbitration or if you want to go to courts.
All right, well, my topic is obviously much more interesting, so
yes.
I'm going to go first. What I want to talk about is this case. It's called Krispy Kreme Donuts Securities Litigation, and it comes out of North Carolina. Just wrapped up in the end of last year, late December. With some developments in this particular case, which in themselves aren't that interesting to most people, but they do teach us some interesting lessons. What happened in this case was the claimants who were stockholders in Krispy Kreme, because it's a public company, of course, they had raised some allegations, which we typically see in more franchise-type litigation, but they brought it in the securities forum. What they claim essentially is that Krispy Kreme officers and managers realized that there were major problems in sales and in the supply chain, et cetera, but they kept pushing out franchises and they kept talking expansion and telling the greater market that that's what was going to happen. It was also alleged they did something called channel stuffing, which is where you deliberately overload your retail, your franchise outlets with product. That way, the company looks very profitable for earnings, but it really doesn't help the franchisees or even the mid-level franchisors. So what happened in the case here is it was interpreted and brought as a fraud claim, a securities fraud claim, which as this case developed, it came to be that they had to plead their fraud very particularly on the issue of whether or not the officers knew in advance and concealed that there were problems. And the problem for Krispy Kreme and its management was that they had been making apparently bragging statements saying how strong and productive and great sales, et cetera. So they're making these statements at the same time that the documents seem to show that they knew or should have known that the company was underwater. And what does that mean for mid-level franchisors or franchisees? I think it means a few things. What I get out of it is essentially two lessons. And the first one is, if you're a franchisee or even a mid-level franchisor for a public company, you've got to think slightly different than a non-public company. Because not only is the franchisor, the master franchisor, the top franchisor, not only are they interested in the profits from the franchise, but they're also interested in the profits from the greater securities market. So they're worried about earnings and the stock price and executives and their compensation, which is an issue, Adam, as you know, that has come over and over again, the late 90s and into the 2000s, executive compensation driving statements and driving company actions which really don't match up with what the company should be doing. So you want to keep an eye on that. But also it goes back to the old lesson for franchisees in particular, which is, and for franchisors too, when they're filing their or setting their UFOCs up, which is, what do you know as a franchisor at the time you are selling franchises out there in the market? What are you telling people about your expansion plans? What kind of due diligence do you have at that moment that matches your expansion plans and statements to what's really going on in the franchise? And that's the kind of issue that we see over and over and over again. And it's just interesting to see this case blend that issue over into a securities fraud issue. So, and bottom line, I guess, is if you're a franchisee or a level franchisor for a public company, you want to keep your eyes out both up and down the chain for the fact that there's another motive at stake, another profit motive at stake that you need to keep your eyes on. So you want to be extremely truthful as a franchisor at the time that you're selling the franchises, knowing that there may be a time when there's a look back, and maybe a franchisee is going to come up to you a year later or 2 years later and say, wait a minute, you sold me on this expansion plan into the Northeast when you knew that your sales were dying on the vine at the same time. And there could be liability for the up the chain, up the franchisor chain for that. So it's a warning sign for franchisors, and it's also a caveat, an additional caveat for franchisees. So that's my take on this case. Adam, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but it struck me as an interesting lesson, and of course, coming out of a Krispy Kreme background, I know that's dear to your heart. I thought it was an interesting case.
Yes, I mean, the thing that struck me is distinguishing between a franchisor that's a public company versus a closely held company. And from the perspective of a franchisee, if you are interested in purchasing a franchise from a public company, you oftentimes have additional information beyond just the initial disclosure that SEC requirements require you to make, including potential earning claims that are not that a franchisor is often reluctant to make. So it does provide you an opportunity to do a little bit more due diligence, but could also lead to lawsuits from a franchisor's perspective because it's having them disclose certain things that they ordinarily would not disclose. I guess my overall recommendation would be if you are interested in purchasing a franchise from a public corporation, to just alert an attorney and have him review all the disclosure documents as well as any SEC filings.
Adam, I know you've drafted UFOCs for franchisors. Is there anything you could do at that level or any language that you would think about adding to the UFOC to try to cover this kind of situation where maybe there's some what we call puff going out by the franchisor as far as earnings and sales and that kind of thing, but there seems to be a little bit of an inconsistency with the actual sales or earnings, and that needs to be somehow addressed in the UFOC to protect the franchisor from this kind of litigation?
From a franchisor's perspective, I would probably set them up with a subsidiary company to sell the franchises and then try to limit the UFOC disclosures to only the subsidiary. The trick is, if the parent company, which in that case would be a public corporation, was responsible or strongly affiliated with any of the subsidiary's obligations, then you also have to disclose various items concerning the parent. So I would try to separate them out, have them run as separate companies, make a subsidiary a standalone company to avoid the issues that came up in the case that you just talked about.
Mm. And would there be any difference between a non-reporting state or a reporting state as far as this kind of disclosure?
No, because the Federal Trade Commission regulations are nationwide. The states that require you to register will add, sometimes have additional requirements, but nonetheless, you'll still be required to make all your basic disclosures no matter what state you're in.
All right. Well, Adam, you wanted to talk about arbitration, so I'm going to head you over to that direction. What's going on there?
Every franchisor, when they make their franchise agreement, one thing they have to decide is if there's a dispute, if they want it to take place in a public forum, such as a court, or if they want to handle it privately in arbitration. Historically, arbitration was much quicker, was much cheaper. It also wasn't disclosed and wasn't part of public record. As time goes on, arbitration, because it's becoming a very popular option, more and more people are using it. It's not always now the quicker and cheaper way to go. In addition, you don't have some of the remedies that you have in court, such as injunctive relief and some of the discovery options that you have available. So it's always a balancing act in terms of which direction you want to go.
What's the New Jersey statute say about arbitration
clauses? Well, New Jersey had a actually has a unique perspective on forum selection clauses that some states have, but most don't. Actually, the New Jersey Supreme Court in the mid-90s, in a case called Cubis versus Persic Associates versus Sun Microsystems, basically found that forum selection clauses in New Jersey are unenforceable. The rationale was that these contracts are what we call contracts of adhesion, meaning they're essentially take-it-or-leave-it contracts. There's a very large disparity in terms of the bargaining power between the franchisor and the franchisee. So in essence, the franchisee has to accept the terms as is or move on to another investment. The Supreme Court found the selection clause unconscionable from the standpoint of requiring a franchisee under those terms to have to go out to the state that the franchisor requires and litigate in that state, which they found to be potentially burdensome, potentially overly expensive, and
it would have a chilling effect
on a franchisee asserting its rights. So from a public policy standpoint, the Supreme Court of New Jersey held them unenforceable. There's been other states that have followed suit. However, one of the trends that took place in the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Fourth Circuit out in California were that arbitration clauses were enforceable and overrode any case law that rendered forum selection clauses unenforceable.
That's kind of strange, isn't it? Because in California, you'd think would go the other way.
Well, you would think that. Yeah. But the pro-arbitration policy under the Federal Arbitration Act, you know, just as they don't want a chilling effect on franchisees, they also don't want a chilling effect on people going to arbitration and not clogging up the courts. Now, the Third Circuit, in a significant decision this past November, came down with a decision that held that the holding in Cubis by the New Jersey Supreme Court would not apply if it was an arbitration clause. Meaning, if a franchisor said you had to arbitrate in its home state, let's just say Arizona by example, that would be enforceable. Versus if a franchisor said you had to litigate in our home state and go to the court system in Arizona, which still would not be unenforceable. John, in terms of the pro-arbitration policy behind the FAA and some of the public policy behind that, can you just talk a minute about what they're trying to protect there and why they don't want it to have a chilling effect on that?
Well, the general policy, of course, is to promote arbitration. I'm not entirely, from a litigator's point of view, I'm not entirely sure why that's always been a promotion that the state legislatures and even the federal government, of course, the FAA likes to do, but it is something that's always in the background, or it does something that's always behind these cases. With your case, or your recent case in the Third Circuit, seeming to contradict the New Jersey Supreme Court, what's the bottom line? Say I'm a franchisor I have a franchise out of, I don't know, Louisiana, and my franchisee is in New Jersey, and we have a dispute with an arbitration clause. Where can that do I get to bring it back to Louisiana, or do I have to go to New Jersey?
For an arbitration clause, you'd have to bring it back to Louisiana. And from the perspective of the Third Circuit, they would say that they didn't contradict the Cubis decision rendered by the New Jersey Supreme Court. They would say that the decision was about a forum selection clause applying to courts, not to arbitrations, and it doesn't extend beyond that. Now, it was also an unreported decision, meaning that it's persuasive, but it wouldn't be a binding precedent.
Right, so that's significant, too. It certainly makes the decision of an arbitration clause versus no arbitration clause in UFOC an extremely important decision, I would think, from a litigator's point of view. If you're drafting a UFOC, generally speaking, for a franchisor in, I don't know, say New Jersey, what would you choose? What would you recommend as a general rule?
I would recommend that you stick with an arbitration forum because you know it will be enforceable. All the decisions that have been coming down have held that any decisions that render these forum selection clauses unenforceable don't apply to arbitration clauses. So I would say to ensure that you have the forum, your home forum, and to require the franchisee to come to you, I would stick with an arbitration clause. The benefit used to also be that if it was an arbitration versus a court decision, you didn't have to report it under item 4 of the UFOC regarding past litigation. That's all changing now.
I guess that's good news in a way for both franchisors and the franchisees, because arbitration generally is faster, it's less expensive, and both parties can get the issue resolved quicker. So I guess that's generally a positive development for us. But anyway, all right, we're going to wrap up for today.
Why don't we continue this conversation over some Krispy Kreme donuts?
Krispy Kremes? All right, you're buying. Yes. All right, thanks. This is John McDonald again and Adam Siegelheim. We're in the Franchise Practices Group at Stark & Stark. And if anyone wants to further the conversation with us or talk about any other issues, please reach out to us. You can use our website, stark-stark.com. Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's installment of the New Jersey Legal Update by Stark & Stark. And be sure to join us each and every Friday for another insightful discussion. We'd like to hear from you. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information about Stark & Stark and the services we provide, email us at podcast@stark-stark.com.